they say. So last time, I rushed through Abigail's start, her set when she sets out to deter David's assault, at the beginning of that section in chapter 25, sentences 14 to 17. And so I said, we'll start with your questions this time. But just to recap and refresh everybody's memory, what we saw was that after Naval rejected the request from David's men, and in such rude fashion, David tells his men, prepare for battle. He has them gird their swords. He goes along as well. He's got 400 men, leaving 200 behind. We talked about the ratio. We talked about whether this is an appropriate reaction for David. We gave three different explanations for why David has this reaction. And then we talked about how one of the youths, we said we don't know if it's her youth or whether it's Nabal's youth. Either way, somebody thinks Abigail is able to help. And somebody reports to Abigail what has happened and says that David sent this group, Livarech, to bless Nabal. We discussed, is that the Kol Achai? Is that the rest of the sentence? Either way, Naval's reaction is described as being very negative to this. Vayo'at Bahem, which we said could mean he treated them like a predatory bird or a scavenger bird, or Ga'ar Bahem, he scolded them, he rebuked them, he humiliated them. And David's men are wonderful. David's men, they protected us. They were like a wall protecting us. And now we are in real trouble because David is on the attack and there's no talking to him. And that was the last bit that we did. Statement of the youth is, you can't talk to him. Basically, it's too late for talking this out. The attack is guaranteed. We gave different ways to read that phrase. But that's where we left things last time. So were there questions and comments from that? So that brings us to Abigail's actions. Take a look at Pasuk Yudchet, sentence 18. Vatmaher Abigail, vatikach masayim lechem, ushnayim nivleyayin, v'chamesh tzon asuyos, v'chamesh si'im kali, umeatzi mukim, umasayim dveilim, vatasem al hachamorim. Abigail sets out quite the feast to bring to David and his men. I mean, you look at the list here. It's a very impressive list. It says that she sends 200 loaves of bread, 2 flagons of wine, 5 sheep something. The word asuyot is an interesting word. I'm going to come back to this word. Right now, I'll translate it as prepared. Prepared sheep. We're going to come back to what exactly asuyot could mean. 5 se'ah. Se'ah is a very large volume measure. 5 se'ah of kali, singed grain, dried grain. Me'atzi mukim, 100 raisins. I'm not sure that's enough raisins. I guess it was a delicacy. So, you know, 100 raisins doesn't seem like that much. You've got 600 men. The
Translated as raisin clusters.
Ah, raisin clusters. Okay, that may be better. Raisin clusters. That sounds also like a snack food. Raisin clusters. I feel like that should be something. Okay. And also, masayim dveilim, 200 cakes of pressed figs. So, oh, you know what? Dat Mikra actually makes the point about the raisins. The Dat Mikra edition here. Says umistaber shakavana lo letzimukim prudim. He says logically this isn't talking about individual raisins. Elol oligulei anavim yaveshim. Either would have been bunches, like you're saying, clusters, or alternatively it would have been pressed cakes of raisins. That's this Professor Keel offering that suggestion. But it's interesting to me that this is not a it's not just utilitarian. It's not just like here's bread and meat. But it also has the fruit component. There's dessert here as well. In terms of that word asuyot, that we saw, that I translate as prepared. Does anyone have a translation of sentence 18 that has a different translation of the word asuyot?
Cooked.
Okay. Cooked. Radak offers that maybe they were stuffed. He has the idea that it's that they're stuffed with something. I'm going to come back to it eventually. It's going to take us a little while to get there, but that's a word that has another meaning potentially. So right now, what I just want you to recognize is the broad array of food and delicacies that Abigail is able to send, and not only is she able to send it. But take a look at sentence 19 now. Vatomer lina areha. She told her youths. She has her own group of aides, people at her disposal. Iru lefanai, pass before me. Hinani achrechem ba'a, I'm coming after you. Uli ishah naval lo higida. And she ain't saying anything to Naval. Naval isn't going to find out that this is what she's doing. So, I want to just read you sentence 20, and then I want to come back to sentence 19 and 20 collectively. You'll read them as a set. V'haya hi rocheves al hachamor. She was riding on the donkey. V'yoredes b'seser hahar. She is descending in what sounds like the hidden part of the mountain. V'hinei David v'anashav yoredim likrasa. David and his men are actually directly opposite. Vatif Gosh Osam, and she encounters them. So David and his men encounter Abigail's gift, and then encounter Abigail. Radak says that the point here is to say that when they meet, Abigail is taken by surprise. Because descending Beseser Hahar in the hidden part of the mountain, the idea is that she can't see far away. She's in this part that's sort of blocked by the mountain, and then suddenly she comes around the bend and poof, there's David. That's what Radak reads here, which is gonna fit with what we're gonna see in sentence 23 when she like falls off of the animal before David. That's one way to read it. However, Malbim says that's not what this is trying to say. Rather, the point is, and we'll see it, but well, take a look at source number 3. I'm going to come back to 1 and 2. But take a look at source number 3, where Malbim says, Shayu shnei harim ze neged ze. There are two mountains, one opposite the other. Hi yoredes mehar hazeh, v'david mehar hamagbil lo. She is descending from this mountain. David is descending from the adjacent mountain. So David must have met the youths going before her. By the time David gets to her, he has already seen the food. That's the way Malbim explains why we're outlining this, and it's part of her arrangement. She's making sure that David is going to get the food first. So let me ask you a question. Why does she send the gift first? Why did she send the gift ahead? Why didn't she go with the gift?
Maybe she was afraid.
Afraid of what?
He was expecting the food.
Yeah.
And she just hopped alone. She may be afraid that some people think she has a negative message or that mm-hmm. she's from his camp, something could happen. This way, it appeases him.
Right.
He gets the food, he knows he can trust her.
Right. So Ralbag and Abarbanel take Susan's approach, and they say it's about softening him up before she meets him. That's one approach. Malbim offers another, Janine. You're muted.
It reminds me a little bit of Yaakov and Esau.
Yes. And we're getting to that. Hang in there. Malbim suggests, if you take a look at source number 1, she's worried that if they go with her, Naval is going to find out. And so she said, the text says specifically, she doesn't tell Naval. She doesn't want Naval to know. So that's another possibility. But I had a third idea. I wonder if by sending it, it will allow David to think that Nabal sent it. In other words, until Nabal sees her, he has no reason to think this is Abigail. He's going to think Nabal changed his mind and he'll back down. You know, I feel like that's a reasonable read. But you have to note what Janine pointed out. Yaakov is on his way back into Israel with his family, right? And he knows he has to deal with Esav. And so he sends messengers ahead with a gift to Esav, right? He prepares in three different ways. He davens to Hashem, he sends the gift, and he prepares for war. Those are David's, three strategies. But for sure, oh, you know what? Hang on one second. That's weird. The internet cable was not in properly. Maybe that's why there was trouble. Let's see if this works better. Not only do we see that she sends a gift, much like what Yaakov sent, but also, there's another piece of it. What's the language that she uses? Yeah, hang on one second. It'll stop freezing in a moment. I'm switching between wireless internet and wired internet, and it's gonna jump while it does it. It has to figure out what it's doing. David, Abigail sent a gift to David. That's like Yaakov sends a gift facing Esav. We've already seen that David has 400 men with him, right? Which amplifies the Yaakov versus Esav meeting. But in particular, if you look on your sheet in source number 2, I noted for you there the pasuk that Yaakov, when Yaakov addresses his men and tells them to bring the gift, Yaakov says to them, Ivru lefanai, pass before me, which is the same phrase that Abigail uses when she sends the gift. Pass before me. We're trying to build up here very clearly an echo of the Yaakov-Esav meeting. Clear? We don't yet know why, meaning we haven't yet understood why this is happening, but it's very clear that this is meant to echo Yaakov meeting Esav. Okay, more to come about that. But now I want to talk a little bit about Abigail's overall situation. And this is something that I really hope your internet and my internet hold out, because this is something that I think is a unique read, but once you look at the text carefully, you have no choice but to see it this way. I think it's very clear. Number one, I'm going to build a case here first by showing you textual evidence. Go back to sentence 3, please. Chapter 25, sentence 3. Notice the description of Nabal and Abigail, right? We read it a few weeks ago. We were told that Abigail is somebody of great intellect. She's somebody who is attractive. How did we describe Nabal? What did it say? Sorry? He was. I can't hear you well.
I said, it says in my English that he was hard of evil deeds.
Of
Kalei from Kalei.
Right. Evil deeds. Leave aside the Kalibi, which we spent a lot of time on. But he's somebody of evil deeds. This could be read, and I think the way people usually read it, as foreshadowing. It's telling us, things are going to be bad here in this story because Nabal's a bad guy, but Abigail is good. But I think it's doing more than that. I think it's giving us historical information. Before this story, Nabal is already somebody of bad deeds. And that's going to matter a great deal as we read this. That's piece number one, is that there is a history of Nabal being a bad guy. That's number one. Number two, the Na'ar, right? The Na'ar reports to Abigail and expects her to know what to do in response to the situation, right? Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. The Nar expects Abigail to know what to do in this situation. How in the world is she going to know what to do? Abigail was entirely out of the loop, right? He had to tell her, David's men have been helping us and so on. The second piece of this, again, is that the youth expects Abigail to know what to do, even though she knows nothing about what's going on. She knows nothing about David's men, right? It sounds almost like Natan appealing to Bathsheba in the beginning of Malachim, telling her, you know, Adoniyahu is claiming he's going to be the king and it's going to be a problem for Shlomo. You know, she knows nothing, and he's weighing in. They're coming to Abigail, who's been out of the loop, and expecting her to act, and she's Nabal's wife. Like, you know, hang on for 1 second, please. They're coming to Abigail, who is Nabal's wife. I see your hand, Ricky. Yeah, there's no reason for them to think that she's going to help. Why do they believe that Abigail is actually going to make things better? You know, Nabal just turned David down cold. If I'm the Na'ar, and I'm worried that David is going to come attack, I send the food myself before I go to Abigail. Ricky, you were going to say?
First of all, it's not certain that she didn't know. Sometimes when we present a picture, an argument, we sort of sum up what happened. So she may know, but it kind of summarizes it and he sets her up.
Could be.
Or what she would do. Secondly, she was obviously well known to the people working around her as somebody very capable, somebody who makes her own decisions. She's very smart, it's told. It didn't surprise me at all that she acted this way.
So what you're saying is a piece of what's going on. I'm going to give a bigger picture, but I think that is definitely a piece of it. Claudette?
Maybe Abigail has a pattern of cleaning up the mess for an apartment.
Bingo. Now we're talking. Claudette and I are on the same page. I'm just going to play it out a little further in the text first, but then I'm going to come back to that. Janine?
Well, just it says she's tovat seichel, which means she seems to be proactive. We've seen wise women before. We've seen Rivka know what to do. We've seen Bathsheba. I mean, this is not such a shock. And if you know that she's not only better, but smarter than Nabal, the servant might think she's the one that's going to fix the situation. She's
maybe
a capable woman.
Maybe. Entirely possible but it's gonna, I think it's gonna fit with what we're about to see next, in the Psukim. Abigail, for her part, right, in what we read today in sentence 18, is not at all surprised. Right? She's not surprised. Whether that's because she knew some of the details before, like Ricky is suggesting, or just because she's sharp, or because she has a history, whatever it is, she's not surprised, and she's fast. She responds quickly. We put this food together, we put that food together, and she has an array of helpers who respond to her orders. She sends the gift with her ne'arim. You know, Malbim makes the point that she arranges the gift wisely, right? Not getting caught, not going along with the gift, making sure David receives it first with the route that she chooses by the mountain. So my argument is, as Claudette suggests, that Nabal must have done this before with other people. This isn't new. It's new to us, because this is the first time he did it with David, but Nabal has, as the text indicated, a history. And that's why we're going to see Abigail describe this as Nabal's character trait. As we go along, she's going to say to David, this is who he is. Kishmo Kein Hu. He is like his name, we're going to see her say. This is something she has a lot of familiarity with, and she's used to cleaning up his messes. It may even be why she has her own Ne'arim. She uses them for damage control. My picture of Abigail, hang in there, please don't raise hands yet, because I wanted to just make one more point that I think is very important here, is Abigail strikes me in this story as wealthy but miserable. Meaning she's taken care of by Naval, but she's cleaning up his messes. And she, as we're going to see, is extremely righteous, which is going to make her even more miserable about Naval's behavior. That's going to come across in her speech to David. The righteousness will come across. The way she invokes Hashem, the way she talks about sin and guilt, her blessing she gives to David, it all speaks to somebody of great character who is saddled with Naval for a husband. That's the way that I see it, and it's going to matter ultimately because we know how this story ends. She ends up with David, right? She's becoming freed from Naval and ending up with David. Claudette, you were going to say?
No, I was going to say, because she's accustomed to cleaning up his mess, I think one of the reasons why she went into the background when she sent the food is to give the impression that he is doing this, mm-hmm. You know.
Right.
So she's sitting in the background, but she's just doing all the good deeds to make him look good.
Well, only in the beginning, meaning she's going to tell David directly that the gift is from her.
Right.
So at that point she doesn't. But I think in the beginning, that's the way to calm him down, is to let him think Naval is doing it. Yeah, Susan.
I think it's also a product of the times. She can't divorce, well, she probably could, but from what I understand, only women's lives are out, they divorce. She was stuck with him, but behind his back, she had to do things to make herself feel better about his evil.
What her options are halachically is an interesting question in its own right. But as you know, her options socially would not have been great. Getting out of the marriage would not have... Yeah.
What would happen to her if she divorced? Would she get money?
Right.
She's not in a period where women can't get a job.
I mean, she would... You know, we could argue she'll get the ksuba, but the ksuba is not necessarily going to provide enough for her. Remarriage was very hard. You know, it's not a society in which she's gonna be protected, that's for sure. We don't know anything about the family she comes from in order to know what she might have had as independent, you know, resources.
No, because a woman is righteous and is everything that is right and all of this. Your question is, why does she stay with it?
Well, that wasn't my question. My question.
That's a 2022 question. It's not a question of the time.
Correct. Correct. Okay. I want to show you something else that's outside of the text here. Chazal, the sages, expand upon the righteousness that we've already introduced for her from the beginning of the chapter. Take a look on your sheet at source number 4, Mishnah in Sanhedrin, talking about the command that a king should not have too many wives, right? Lo yarbe lo nashim, from Devarim chapter 17. So the Mishnah says, lo yarbe lo nashim, shouldn't have too many women. Ela shmona esrei, the limit is 18. Not that 18 is a good idea, but simply because when you tally up David's wives and apparently concubines, you get to 18. It's not that we know that there are 18. It's a drash in order to get to the 18. I'm not going there right now. But the point is what comes next. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, marbe hulo, ubilvan shloye mesiros es libo. Rabbi Yehuda says he can marry more wives as long as they do not lead him astray. It's not that he can't have more than 18. It's just that he can't have wives who are going to lead him astray, and our vision of that is always Shlomo's wives and the story with them in Malachim. Rabbi Shimon Omer afilu achas umisirah libo hareza lo yisoena. Rabbi Shimon says, "What are you talking about? If you're talking about an idolatrous wife, like happens with Shlomo, you can't marry them even if it's one wife. Why does that have anything to do with quantity?" So they ask, well then I don't understand. If you're telling me that it's really about whether she is idolatrous or not, is she going to lead him astray or not, then why is there a command? Don't have too many? Afilu ka'avigayo. To teach me that, no, Rabbi Shimon says, there is a cap, even even like Abigail. In other words, it's a machlokes Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon. The debate between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Yehuda's view is that if she's like Abigail, you can marry her even beyond 18. Rabbi Shimon says no. Rabbi Shimon says 18 is the hard cap. That's all you're able to marry. My reason for quoting this is not the discussion about kings and how many women they can marry. My point is that the illustration of a righteous wife, their ultimate example, is Abigail. That's why I mention it here. There are lots of righteous women in Tanakh, including in David's life, right? As Janine noted, we have, you know, many women we could have drawn on as models. But Abigail is the one who's taken as the sample. Take a look also at source number 5. Gemara and Megillah. We've talked about this Gemara off and on in various contexts. Sheva Nevios, Manet Ninhu. The Gemara wants to know, who are the 7 biblical prophetesses who have their prophecies recorded? And the list is Sarah, Miriam, Devorah, Chana, Abigail, Huldah. That's our list. Actually, I stopped short. That's funny. That's only 6. Esther is the 7th. I'm not sure why I stopped there. That's funny. Okay. So the Gemara then wants to know, where does Abigail experience prophecy? Where is that? So it's based on verses that we haven't yet seen. So it's not going to make a whole lot of sense to us yet. But as you read through it, you'll see that Abigail is going to say to David, don't let this thing with Nabal, be an obstacle for you. Meaning if you sin, it's going to be an obstacle for you. It will be a stumbling block for you. But she says, don't let this be your stumbling block. So the Gemara says that's because something else is going to happen that will be a stumbling block, and that's going to be what happens with Bathsheba. So she is foretelling something else is going to happen that's bad. That's one explanation. Second explanation for where her prophecy is that we're going to see her say to David, may Hashem benefit you, veitiv Hashem ladoni, v'zacharta es amasecha, and remember your maidservant. You should remember me down the line. And of course, that's what ends up happening. Nabal dies. And so the idea is that she is foretelling the death of Nabal. That's the that's a second approach. One other approach is found in source number 6, a medrash on something else that we haven't yet seen Abigail say. She's going to say to David a phrase which, unfortunately, we're all probably familiar with. She says, "V'haysa nefesh Adoni tsrura b'tsror hachayim." Right? You've seen that on stones at a cemetery. Usually it's with an acronym. Taf, Nun, Sadi, Bet, Hey, Tien, Ishmasa, Tzura, Bitzur, HaChayim. The soul should be bound up in the bond of life. So that comes from Abigail. It comes from the bracha, the blessing that Abigail gives to David. So the Medrash here says that what she was saying to David is, it's tied in here in this Medrash to a verse in Yeshaya, in Isaiah. But the point is, that Hashem gathers in the souls of the righteous gently and with honor. So that's what she's saying to David, and that's her nevuah. That's her prophecy, that she is aware that that's what will happen for David. Again, my point is not so much to analyze the verses that we haven't yet seen. My point is just to show you how the Medrash views Abigail. She is the epitome of the righteous woman. She is a prophetess. I didn't bring you on the sheet because I felt like I was already bringing you a lot of material on this. But Otsar Midrashim is a collection of Midrashim, relatively late Midrashim, I think, usually. One of them, one of these Midrashim in Otsar Midrashim, describes Gan Eden as a set of rooms. And there's room after room after room for righteous women. So Abigail has a room beside the rooms of Batya, the daughter of Paro, who saved Moshe, Yocheved, Miriam, Chulda the prophetess, and the Imahot, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah. probably Bila Zilpa. I don't know, it just says Imahot, the mothers, the matriarchs. So that puts her in pretty good company. There's another Medrash in Otzer Midrashim that lists 23 outstanding righteous women from Tanakh, and she is on that list as well. Finally, one other Medrash that I wanted to bring you in source number 7. When Yaakov and David meet, Yaakov and Esav meet. So Yaakov says to Esav, Vayhili shor v'chamor tzon v'eved v'shivcha. He describes his wealth. He describes what he has. He says, I have oxen, I have donkeys, I have sheep, I have male servants, I have female servants. So the Medrash says that Yaakov is actually not talking about his wealth. Rather, he's invoking weapons that he has, that he can use against Esav. He's saying, I have great descendants with great merit. You can't stand against me. And so, in that light, the Medrash says, the shor, the ox, is Yosef, because the ox is a symbol of Yosef. The donkey is Yisachar, because Yisachar is Chamor Garem. He's the donkey, and Yisachar's descendants are Torah scholars. Tzon, the sheep, that's the Jewish people as a whole, because we are described as sheep. Eved is David. He is the Eved, the servant of God. And Shifcha is Abigail, because she is going to refer to herself as a Shifcha, as a maid. So again, you see her being brought out as a great figure. And that's what I wanted to show you there. But I wanted to highlight one other point. And this takes us back to sentence 18. Within our story, when we listed what was brought out, right, all the food that they sent, so we saw the word tzon asuyot, which I translated as prepared sheep, or someone had cooked. I had another one who said stuffed. But there's a Gemara in Chulin which takes it a different way altogether. This is going to require a little bit of explanation, but I think it's worthwhile. There is a halacha. There's a law called Reishis Hagez. Reishis Hagez means the first of your wool. When you shear your sheep, you have to give the first of the wool as a gift to the Kohanim. Right? People, I think, generally are not aware of this because, you know, we don't really shear sheep too often. It's not necessarily something we're that familiar with. But take a look at source number 8, where I brought you a Mishnah. The Mishnah says, it's not as though you just, any amount of wool that you shear triggers this. There's a minimum. Mishnah says, Ve'eru noheg ela b'maruba. It only applies to a large amount. If you shear a lot of wool, then you do it. Ve'kama hu maruba. So how much is a lot? Says the Mishnah. I don't know what a lot means. Give me a measurement. So Beit Shammai says, Shtei rechelot. Two ewes is already enough. You shear two ewes, then you have to give to the Kohen. Beis Hillel says no. Beis Hillel says 5. Why 5? Because it says here, Chamesh Tzon Asuyot, that Abigail sent 5 sheep prepared. What does this have to do with anything? Why are you using this verse? What exactly is this about? So as the Gemara is going to explain, from Rav Kahana, the English is on the next side. Asuyot, when we say prepared, what that means is tithed. That she had tithed these animals. Remember, this is the time of the shearing of the sheep, right? That's how this whole thing started. So she, number one, took care of making sure that the wool was given to the Kohanim. That's the first piece of it. And number two, that when you slaughter an animal, certain parts have to be given to the Kohen as a gift. She took care of that as well. So this is a very long-winded way to try to explain that the Abigail is held up as an icon of righteousness, such that when she sends the sheep and it says Asuyot, we interpret Asuyot not just to mean prepared, but tithed. She made sure that everything was perfect. That's the idea. Clear? Was that at all helpful? The last bit with the Gemara? Okay, good. So,
Rabbi,
yes.
Wait. Is there any precedent where asuyot, or the singular asuy, is a tie anywhere else?
So, the answer is yes. I'm just trying to think where. I'm blanking right now. If I get a chance, I'll look it up for you, because the answer is yes. I'm just not remembering right now where. I will
but
note for you.
They are basing it on something. They're not
saying,
well, yes. It has a basis.
So. Yes. Yeah. I will note for you, if you look at the Gemara itself that I brought on the page, you see Rav Ashi actually takes it differently. He says Asiyot is from a slightly different form of this word, me'asot et ba'alehen. They force the owner, saying, hey, get up and tithe us. There's a certain quantity now for you to tithe. And that's a term that we also see elsewhere. But I need to find you the reference for where this is used.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
I saw it as we ought, as if they're like prepared just so they can already cook them.
Yeah, and that was the pshat read. That was for sure the straight read of the sentence, without a doubt. What this is doing here is Medrash building on, number one, the fact that it said asuyot for the sheep, like presumably all these things were asuyot. Why did you need to say it just for the sheep?
Because grain and whatever you cook yourself, the sheep has to be first skinned and then cut and then whatever.
Oh, so you're going to say this has more processing? Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. But I think that's one piece of what it's building on here. And that's also the known approach to Abigail as somebody of great righteousness. So that's what we're seeing also. But I want to look for the basis in terms of that word, asuyot, because I believe there is precedent for it. So in sum, for what we've seen here, the youths, whether Nabal's youths or Abigail's youths, are looking to Abigail to clean up Nabal's mess. And she takes charge. Were there any other comments on this section before we go forward?
Yeah.
Yeah, Agnes.
So how does she have the authority to do this? Like, how much autonomy does she have within the household? You know, I mean, we see the Denise and the boy. There were other examples of righteous women who took charge, like Zipporah, who went and did the Bris Mila. But they have cooperative husbands. I mean, she doesn't have a cooperative husband.
Yep. And that's part of what drives me here. There's a history. This isn't the first time she's doing this. It must be that there is a pattern of cleaning up Nabal's messes. You're right.
So what's her motivation? If David is threatening to kill her and she can't stand the guy, I mean, why not let him get killed?
So,
I mean, what was she being threatened as well?
Right. So the answer to me is probably, if I wanted to just be very cold about it, sentence 17. When the youth says to her, "Kol sahara el adonenu ve'al kol beiso," it isn't going to end with him. You know, that would be the simple read that I would have. Ruth and then Etty. And then
she was a wealthy woman. So they probably operated sort of not exactly two households, but the women were separate from the men. And she could probably do a lot of things without him knowing.
I'm not so sure, especially when you have a guy who's really so
true.
You know. So Nabal, for lack of a better word. Like, I'm not so sure, but she does it, and she's done it before.
I mean, as we said, you know, she's a very smart woman.
Yes.
Clever, and she's also kind-hearted, a good person. So she has that motivation to do something behind her husband's back.
I think so. Etty, Claudette, and then Ricky.
I wanted to answer Agnes that says, how can she do that? She's the mistress of the house, so she has access to all these things.
You're not talking about preparing a little meal here. You're talking about sending out 200 loaves of bread, you know, the 5 sa'ah of grain, 5 animals. Like, you don't just do that, I don't think. I think that, to my mind, this is a response that she has because there's a pattern that she's already done this before and has built up to this. Claudette.
course,
yes.
I think David would recognize his grandmother in Abigail.
It's an interesting thought for sure. She is on the list, not a list of prophetesses, but she is on the list of the righteous women in general in that Otsar Midrashim, yes. Would he have recognized,
the Hesed.
Yeah, yeah, it's an interesting point, that trait. Depending a little bit on how we view it as Chesed, because David thinks his men earned it, but yes. Ricky. Yeah, no, this is...
freshly made.
I mean, maybe it's pita, I don't know.
Well, obviously it's not bread and challahs.
Yeah.
But, you know, 200 sounds like...
Right. Yeah, no, it's for sure true. Okay, so let's see what happens. We still have some time. Pasuk Chaf Aleph, sentence 21. Let's see where this goes. What we're going to see here is David's full violent intent... And then Abigail is going to give an extended speech talking him down. So, the David Amar, David said, and here actually I'll introduce it by saying that it's unclear how to read the next two sentences. What's coming up here, David's speech that he's about to give, most commentators believe that David's speech is before he meets Abigail. It's the text recapping what David said to himself, according to Rashi, or what David said to his men, according to Abarbanel. But it's, even though it's weird, because sentence 20 ended, but Tifgosho some, she met them. So I would think that means this isn't a conversation. But most commentators don't believe that. Malbim, though, disagrees. Malbim says, that David, here, take a look at source number 9. You'll see it right there. Kasher pagash as narei Naval v'chamorav nosos baru mazon. David encounters Naval's youths and the donkeys carrying all of this grain and all of this food. Shechashav kiochim el ma'on el beiso. He thought they were going to Naval's home in Ma'on. He didn't think it was a gift for him. He thought this is, something that they're just taking to their home. So if I'm right that she sends it ahead, as potentially a way to, for David to think that it's a gift for him, it backfired. Amar la nashav, David said to his men, Ach la sheker shamarti es kol asher lazeh, halich po likroseinu. It was for nothing that I guarded this guy's property. Sheshamarnu rechush hazeh. You're going to see that in the text itself momentarily. That David says this. And now Heshiv Ra'at Tachas Tova, he gave me bad for my good. Avigail Shama'a HaDevarim Ha'elev Al-Yedekach Hikira V'Rasa as David Shehu Diber Kol Zos. Avigail heard it, and so she recognized and saw David saying all of this. In other words, according to most commentators, this is just the text recapping what David had said before. However, according to the Malbim, no. This is Abigail's introduction to David, is overhearing David saying the following. Got it? Two different ways to look at it. So what does David say? We've already seen Malbim's version of it, but let's see it in the text. V'David Amar, David said, Ach la sheker shamarti es kol asher lazeh bamidbar. For a falsehood, for nothing, as Radak translates it, I guarded all of this guy's stuff in the wilderness. V'lo nifkan mikol ha'shalom me'uma. Nothing. They lost nothing in that. V'yashav li ra'at tachas tova. And he answers me with bad for good. He makes all, like Malbim's read is, he's prepared all this food for himself and he can't give me anything. Ko yaseh elokim lo'ayvei David v'cho yosif. So may God do to David's enemies. If I even leave anything from morning till morning, even a mashtin bikir. Mashtin bikir, literally, one who urinates against a wall. According to the Yerushalmi on this, it means a dog. There's the reference. Targum, Ralbag have other ideas. You get the picture, though. The only note that I would make, though, on this is, when he says, so may God do to my enemies, two different approaches. Radak says this is a euphemism when he says my enemies. He means himself. And what he's saying is, that God should harm him, should harm David, if he doesn't eradicate Nabal and his men. That's Radak's reading. Whereas Abarbanel says no. Abarbanel says David is saying, may God give my enemy wealth if I don't eradicate them. Right? He's saying, if I don't do this to them, may God give them a lot of wealth. Which would bother me even more, that my enemies should not only survive, but that they should get riches. Two notes here on David's outrage. First of all, David's outrage fits with all of the approaches that we brought when we discussed the question of why David is so harsh, right? Whether it's because he views this fellow as a threat to the throne, whether it's because he won't engage in chesed, but especially the third approach that we brought. David is acting like a king. David is taking care of the population, and it brings him nothing. Right? That's what David is so angry about. David is like, I helped the people in Keilah, and they were ready to turn me over to Shaul. Here I am now in Paran, and my men spend months guarding him, and he isn't willing to share anything with me. David is just outraged. He's incensed. Like, where is the justice? That's number one. But number two, taking oaths and issuing curses is really popular in that era. We see it throughout Shmuel. We see it in Malachim, right? Eli took such a vow back in Shmuel Aleph Paragimel in chapter 3. When he said to Shmuel, you know, if you don't tell me what the prophecy was that you were told, such and such is going to happen to you instead. Shaul, when Yehonatan ate, right? Shaul had taken the oath that the soldiers shouldn't eat, and Yehonatan ate, and he found out, and he swears that he's gonna punish Yehonatan. Yehonatan did his own oath about himself. When David said, Yonatan, are you going to betray me? Yonatan takes an oath about what should befall him. And so on, through Shmuel and through Malachim. And David does it. David is going to do it a bunch of times. David is going to swear in chapter 26. If you jump ahead, it's right here. Chapter 26, sentence 10. When he has the opportunity to harm Shaul. And David's men say to him that he should harm Shaul. David swears, Chai Hashem, by the life of God, Ki Em Hashem Yigafenu, God is going to strike him, or his day should come, but David swears, I am not going to be the one to do it. In Shmuel Bet, Yoav, David's general, is going to kill Avner, who had been Shaul's general. And David is going to swear that he won't eat that day, he's so upset. And we see it over and over again. It's a style that goes on in those days, and that's, I think, what we're seeing from David in this speech. Clear? Very harsh, for sure. But that's the idea. The phrase "mashtin bikir" is going to come up elsewhere in Tanakh as well. We'll have to see that. Claudette, and then Susan. Claudette. You're muted.
Can you hear me?
Yes, now. Yeah.
You know what I find about this story and David's actions in taking care of the people? Where is Shaul? We're talking here about two kings in action, because David is taking care of the people and Shaul maybe in the background.
So we don't have any sense of what Shaul is doing right now, but I would note that by going to Paran, David has moved out of Shaul's immediate orbit. He's close to the land of the Philistines now. And we even said that was one explanation for why David went there, was because of that. He's out of Shaul's immediate grasp, I think. That's what I would have said. Susan?
I'm feeling this is sort of out of character for David. He's taken so, for David, he's taken so much. It's almost to me like the straw that broke the camel's back.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I've had it. I can't take any more. I've been patient. I've been good to everybody else. This is it. No more. He's no
Yeah.
And it strikes me that he's had it.
I hear that. I hear it. And I think it fits with that third approach, that nothing is happening the way it's supposed to happen. And he is, as you said, he's been the good guy. Not just he's taken it, but he's given. He's benefited everybody else. And, you know, why is this happening to him?
Something has to explain such a change of behavior.
Yeah. We'll see. Because we're going to find out a lot more about David, God willing, in the Prakim ahead. David okay. is, it, there are always layers with David. Okay. So take a look at what comes next. We're just going to introduce this, because it's 229. I'm sorry the internet was poor in the beginning, but at least it recovered, and now we're better off. So look what happens. Actually, you know what? I'm going to skip the initial part of it where she meets David. I want to show you the problem. Jump to Pasuk Chav Dalet, sentence 24. I'm skipping her, descending from the donkey. Vatipol al raglav, she fell at his feet. Vatomer, and she said, Bi ani Adoni he'avon. I am the guilty one. Is that true? And lest you think that this is just her being really, self-effacing and saying, I'm going to take the blame. Note that in sentence 25, the end of the sentence, she's going to say, I didn't see the youths you sent. Don't blame me. So I don't understand. Either you are guilty or you're not guilty. So that's something I want to talk about next time. What exactly is her strategy here for what she says to David? Does she mean that she did something wrong? Does she not mean it? We're going to see a bizarre approach from Malbim. He's gone way out of the text, but I think it's fascinating. So, God willing, that will be next Thursday. Enjoy the rest of Yom Ha'atzmaut.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And have a good Shabbos.